Welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. 15 to 20 minutes of global news and analysis on tax havens and corruption you won't hear anywhere else. With me, Naomi Fowler. The TaxCast is available to everyone for download and broadcast on www.tackletaxhavens.com. The G20 nations have finally signed up to automatic exchange of information, something the Tax Justice Network's been calling for the last 10 years. They plan to get it in place by 2015. But if the real owners of companies and trusts can remain anonymous and they don't have to register their identities, how much useful information can they really exchange? CEOs of companies often argue they have a fiduciary duty, a legal duty, to find ways to avoid tax for their companies. Now, that's no longer an argument they can make in the UK. This month, the Tax Justice Network sent a new legal opinion from law firm Farrah & Co. to every CEO of every company in the UK's FTSE 100 index. Tax barrister David Quentin helped prepare the legal opinion.
This is very, very simple, basic company law. And if you look at the culture of corporate governance as it's developed, particularly in the UK, I think the point about this opinion is that that culture isn't founded in any legal duties, and that culture is sustained by corporate governance codes that are not enforceable legal duties.
Now work will take place as to how this legal opinion applies in other jurisdictions. The Netherlands has offered to renegotiate potentially harmful tax treaties with 23 developing countries. We'll have more on that later. This month, Italy became the first country to introduce a tax on high-frequency trading and derivatives. And Panama's trying to get itself off tax haven blacklists by tweaking its law on bearer shares, which allow the names of the real owners of company shares to be hidden, even unknown. Now it's going to be a bit easier to identify them. From 2015, owners must appoint an authorised custodian to keep a record of final beneficiaries. And on this month's Roll of Dishonour, top slot goes to UK Prime Minister David Cameron. He claimed that British overseas territories and Crown dependencies should no longer be called tax havens because they've cleaned up their act. Bankable comments from David there. In the Netherlands, Google, IKEA and Starbucks all refused an invitation to attend a Dutch parliamentary hearing on tax. And a roundup of some of this month's fines. In the US, JP Morgan admitted it broke securities laws and was fined $920 million. And just for some perspective on that, they earned $6.5 billion just in the last quarter. No action was taken against any individuals at the bank. A UBS Japanese investment banking subsidiary was also fined $100 million for manipulating the London Interbank Offered Rate, or LIBOR. And in the UK, one of the big four accountancy firms, Deloitte, was found guilty of misconduct over conflicts of interest in its work for the company MG Rover. They were fined £14 million. That's about $22 million, the highest ever fine against any accounting company. Now that fine sounds quite big, but it's actually equivalent to about 2 days' revenue for the company. And that's the roundup for this month. Now we're going to talk to John Christensen at the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month's events. Okay, John, in the Netherlands, we've had a tax justice win, haven't we, this month? The Netherlands has offered to renegotiate tax treaties with 23 developing countries. The Netherlands playing quite a role in depriving treasuries in countries all over the world of tax revenue. We've had famous cases like Yahoo, Google, Starbucks. Obviously, it's extremely harmful to poorer countries. So why is the Netherlands doing this?
Well, the Netherlands has come under a lot of pressure, not least from its own civil society. There's been a lot of pressure from Tax Justice Network activists in the Netherlands and also from the excellent research organisation SOMO, with a particular focus on how Dutch tax treaties have been used to shift profits through the Netherlands. This pressure has been building up, and this announcement is really good news. But I think we need to be a little bit careful because there are many other countries involved. Over 90 countries have tax treaties with the Netherlands. We will need to make sure that the changes which they're proposing, the renegotiations, have some substance behind them. Because in many respects, it appears that this might not actually achieve very much because it's simply requiring companies that are registered in the Netherlands to meet some relatively low-level hurdles, like having a registered office in the Netherlands or requiring at least half of the board members to be officially situated in the Netherlands. These are not particularly onerous requirements. So I think, you know, whilst this is definitely a step in the right direction, we'll need to know whether it's going to achieve a great deal in terms of its impact on existing companies.
So, yes, what the tax justice movement would really want to see is just companies with real business activity in the Netherlands, right, making use of the Dutch tax system.
The good news here is first of all, to have this very high-level government recognition that the Netherlands has been used as a nexus for tax avoidance by multinationals, recognition that they are rerouting profits through Dutch letterbox companies, and that in most cases, these letterbox companies have absolutely no substance. They really don't do any business at all in the Netherlands and are largely used for tax avoidance. We recognise the harm caused and we want to take action. I think that is a major step forward and a great success story.
Right, because the Netherlands Deputy Finance Minister has actually said, quote, over the past 10 years, the trend has been for the number of letterbox companies in the Netherlands to keep growing. I want to turn that trend around. I see the Netherlands being portrayed in a bad light. I don't want to be portrayed in a bad light. So shame being expressed there by the Finance Minister. And Mongolia has possibly played a key role in this new offer that they've made to renegotiate tax treaties with developing countries, haven't they?
Well, this is a fascinating twist to the Netherlands story because Mongolia has actually torn up its tax treaty with the Netherlands. Not just with the Netherlands, they've also torn up existing tax treaties with Luxembourg and Kuwait and various countries. And the reason they're doing this is because they recognise that they're losing a lot of money to tax avoidance by companies using these countries as tax havens. This is very important because Mongolia will shortly start exporting from its massive copper reserves in the Gobi Desert. They're concerned that some of the big companies involved, like Rio Tinto, which is a big Australian Anglo company, will be actively using these countries like the Netherlands to shift their profits. So this is an extraordinary step and will presumably be ringing alarm bells in Netherlands and elsewhere, because they'll recognise that if Mongolia is taking these steps, many other developing countries will probably want to follow.
Right, exactly. Okay, well, we're not going to talk much about the latest G20 meeting in Russia this month because there isn't a lot of significance to discuss, actually. But there is one very interesting development preceding that meeting from China, isn't there? So we might actually be seeing the beginnings of a new era in Chinese cooperation on tax.
China, at the end of August, has signed up to the OECD's Multilateral Convention on Mutual Assistance in Tax Matters. Now, what that means is that China has finally signed up to the process of automatic information exchange. And this is really important because we now have a very powerful G20 member state lining up with other G20 member states and confirming that automatic information exchange is the international standard. This is yet another important milestone in the way to turning this automatic information exchange proposal, which TJN has been backing for the last 10 years, into the global standard and extending it outside Europe into other countries. So this is a very, very welcome step.
And in terms of the limitations of the automatic information exchange that G20 countries are supposed to be committing to, we still have a problem there, don't we, in that anonymous ownership is one of the things many tax havens make a lot of money out of. If you're able to continue to be anonymous, that information can't be exchanged, can it?
Well, this, of course, has been a big game for a very long time. The big game is to hide your identity behind offshore trusts and offshore companies, offshore foundations, in some cases bearer shares as well. If the information can't be obtained, then, of course, it won't be exchanged with other countries. And the really big challenge now facing the OECD and other organisations like the European Union is to make sure that automatic information exchange must not just apply to people, it must also apply to the companies and the trusts and the offshore foundations behind which people hide their identity.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. If you believe what you see and hear in much of the media, you'd think the world's biggest tax haven, Switzerland's huge banking secrecy industry, is finished. And it's thanks to the amazing efforts of the G20 nations and the OECD. But is that really true? Well, no. Far from it. This month, the TaxCast shows you some interesting dance steps. And this dance is called the Swiss Shuffle. Okay, first, let's talk about the basis for the Swiss Shuffle, and then I'll break it down step by step. Here's economist Jim Henry to sum up Switzerland's finance industry for us.
Well, there's 75 to 80 havens in the world today, but one of the key players in the world, and certainly the number one position in the Financial Secrecy Index, is Switzerland. They are several different kinds of haven. They provide, for those who are very wealthy people, there's about 6,000 of them who are using Switzerland as a residential haven. Famous people like Tina Turner, the American rock singer. Another class of activities, their role in the world's kleptocracy. And here we have case after case of where dictator money has shown up. Most recently, I think the Mubarak's and Gaddafi's. Gaddafi actually owned the largest gas station chain in Switzerland at one point and one of the leading soccer teams. And then you also have corporate tax dodging as another game that's being played. And then you also have Switzerland's being used as a conduit for sales of commodities from developing countries. And so the developing countries don't really command a decent price for their exports. A final class of activity has to do with bank secrecy. And so there's 312 banks in Switzerland. Many of them are doing offshore business. They're the largest players in the global private banking market, helping wealthy people move their money to Switzerland and put it beyond the reach of tax authorities.
And that's where the United States got really fed up with Switzerland back in 2008. Then there was the first in a series of investigations by the US Department of Justice that began with the largest Swiss bank, UBS. Lawyer and tax evasion specialist Jack Bloom on Al Jazeera gives us a flavour of the time.
You have to understand what happened here. UBS had a sales force that came to the United States, and they sold the ability to not report on their American tax returns as a way of getting Americans to put their money in UBS. They came to the United States with encrypted computers. They lied on their immigration forms to say they were there for pleasure, not for business. They created a whole system of subterfuge to allow people to bring their money to Switzerland and not report it on U.S. tax returns. This is a felony in the United States. It's a crime for individuals to assist other individuals in impeding the collection of tax.
And so, here we go with the Swiss Shuffle. Take your partners. Starting with the first step now, this one's called We're Not the Only Ones. Here's Peter Kunz of Bern University with a quick demonstration.
You know, it's easy to just finger-pointing against Switzerland, but please keep in mind that other countries in the European Union, Luxembourg, Belgium or Austria, have provisions very similar to the ones in Switzerland.
It's a good move by the Swiss. Of course, the US and the UK are big in this game too, although as a player, Switzerland is about three times larger than the US. Jim Henry again.
The Swiss like to remind everybody that beneficial ownership registration doesn't really exist in the United States. We have Delaware and Nevada and other jurisdictions where there are thousands of companies that we don't know who owns them. Registration of trusts, the same thing applies to the UK. You know, so the United States has this schizophrenic attitude. You know, it's terrible for the Swiss private bankers to come to the United States and help wealthy Americans take their money out. But our private bankers are going all over Latin America and Asia doing the same thing. And the U.S. Treasury is not going to share information with the Mexican Treasury on wealthy Mexicans who have their accounts here.
So let's bring in some partners to join in this dance. A rash of investigations by the US Department of Justice into leading Swiss banks led mainly to deferred prosecution agreements. Now this step's called You're Big, We're Big, Show Us a Bit of Yours and maybe we'll just leave it at that.
in the case of the two deferred prosecution agreements that have been struck by the Justice Department with leading Swiss or foreign institutions with Swiss interests, you know, namely UBS in 2009 and HSBC in 2012. The fines that were actually levied really amounted to little more than parking tickets. I mean, we think of $1.9 billion as a lot of money, but for UBS, that was 5% of their global profits last year. None of their bankers went to jail. They are supposed to be watched by the Justice Department for 5 years under this agreement. But, you know, there was no corporate indictment of either one of these institutions. There was one indictment of a smaller bank, Vegelin, last year, which actually put the bank out of business. But in the case of UBS, the Justice Department under Obama has followed this policy of considering how large an institution is and didn't really want to take responsibility for actually indicting UBS corporately. So they negotiated a settlement. Being indicted corporately would have put any one of them out of business in the United States. And that's, since that's the largest financial market, you know, make it difficult for them to stay in business anywhere without being able to use the clearing facilities in the New York Stock Exchange and so forth. So all told, there are about 5,000 clients in total, U.S. citizens, whose information was given to the IRS. But the IRS at the same time launched amnesty programs for people who had Swiss accounts. And right now they're sitting on about 39,000 of these people who turned themselves in.
So the U.S. Treasury made a tidy sum without too much pressure to address their own haven industry. But other wealthy economies were feeling the pinch of the financial crisis too, and pressure from their own populations to do something about tax havens, the best known of which is, of course, Switzerland. So the next step in the dance is known as the wave your hand in the air like you're really doing something step.
Their original ploy was to go and do so-called Rubik deals with countries like Austria and the UK. The deal there was, I'm Switzerland, you can trust me to tell you how much your citizens have invested in our country, the asset base, and we will write a check. We won't tell you who those people are, but we'll give you an estimated tax owed payment. And then we'll give us something extra for, you know, sort of back money going back to mid-2000s. And
that's, you know, a bit like paying countries off and making them go away.
It's basically a kind of no one gets convicted of tax dodging. We don't really get to audit the accounts directly to see how much money there really is. And there's several indications that they are radically underestimating the size of, say, UK deposits in Switzerland. There's all kinds of assets that are parked in Switzerland that are not really part of this deal. One is discretionary trusts are left out of the Rubik deal that the UK has with Switzerland, for example.
Discretionary trusts. A nice way of distancing individuals from their assets. The UK government got so excited about their Rubik deal with Switzerland, they thought they'd get at least £3.2 billion back into their treasury. Even figures like £7 billion were thrown about. In fact, they got a tiny fraction of that, as the Tax Justice Network pointed out would happen. So far, the Swiss have paid only their guaranteed down payoff. Oh, sorry, I mean down payment of £342 million that was part of the original deal. Then there's another agreement there's been lots of noise about that the Swiss signed up to with the United States. FATCA. It's the US's loophole-ridden Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act. Back to the dance again. This step's a variation on the wave your hand in the air like you're really doing something step. This step's called the wave your other hand in the air like you're really doing something step.
We have to be very careful to look at what they're actually agreeing to. I mean, for example, in the case of the automatic information agreement that they signed up for with the U.S. Treasury, so-called FATCA agreement, the insurance industry in Switzerland is exempt. There's tremendous vault assets in Switzerland, people who have, you know, stashed Picassos and, you know, gold and
safety deposit boxes.
Safety deposits, you know. But in Switzerland, a safety deposit box can be 100 square meters. You know, the Marcoses were reputed to have 10 tons of gold in Geneva's airport. And none of that is subject to U.S. FATCA. None of it's subject to the automatic information exchange. There's just no reporting on it because technically it's outside of the banking sector. Although the banks fully aware of their full service banks, if you're wealthy enough and you get tier one service, you know, they'll help you with your vaults. They'll meet you at the airport.
You bet they will. Although the G20 nations have agreed to implement automatic information exchange, let's not forget that if the real owners of trusts still can't be identified, there's not much information that can be exchanged. So, rounding off the dance now, this step's called the skeletons in the cupboard twist.
You've got to believe that the countries that happen to be members of the G20, like Russia and China and South Africa and Brazil, you know, they may well have politically exposed people, politically important people, who have been recruited as clients of Swiss banks in particular. They're not going to take the initiative to clean up Switzerland. So the skeptics would say they've actually set out to recruit so-called PEPs as clients of the bank. And there's some evidence for that. It's not only developing countries that have Swiss accounts. We've seen Spanish politicians parking funds in Switzerland. We've seen the French budget minister getting caught with Swiss accounts. And I'm sure there are other countries that have leading politicians who are either getting campaign donations from people with Swiss accounts or themselves have Swiss accounts.
And finally, all together now, it's the Keep It in the Family finale.
The closer you look at who's running the Justice Department and who's running the U.S. Treasury, you find that the new Treasury Secretary was head of Citibank Private Banking. His deputy worked at a law firm called WilmerHale, which is, was representing Swiss banks. The chief counsel for the IRS worked at WilmerHale during the 1990s and was actually the foreign registered representative for the Swiss Bankers Association. The key attorney in the criminal case against HSBC was Jamie Gorelick. She was Deputy Attorney General of the United States, and now she's representing firms like BP and HSBC, and she's also at WilmerHale. So, you know, these people are not without influence. They have permeated the Obama administration, the Justice Department, and the Treasury. It's hard for them to look with neutral eyes upon the firms that they might prosecute.
Tax justice campaigners and civil society have achieved a lot. They forced the G20, the G8, and the OECD to talk about tax havens, corruption, and secrecy. The G20 aren't agreeing yet to stop anonymous ownership of assets and companies. If we don't have public registries of real owners, there won't be much useful information for them to exchange. And havens like Switzerland will continue to prosper from secrecy. You've been listening to The Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. For more Taxcasts, you can now find us on iTunes or go to www.tackletaxhavens.com.